Welcome back to To The Point. The Uninhabitable Earth. That's the title of a long article in New York Magazine that became a book 5 years ago. The author, science journalist David Wallace Wells. Uninhabitable Earth lived up to its title. Climate change, Wallace Wells wrote, will be a catastrophic event, even if we take global action to stop it. But just 2 months ago, in the New York Times, he said he'd changed his mind. Sort of. The worst-case scenarios are less likely now than they appeared before, he says. Actions the world has taken have made a difference. But that's hardly the end of the story. After all, we're talking climate change, a threat to the human species, and Wallace Wells still calls himself an alarmist. So what's his assessment of COP27? That's the climate change conference of almost 200 countries that wrapped up recently after 2 weeks plus overtime in Egypt. David Wallace Wells, great to have you back on our podcast.
Good to be here. Great to talk to you.
Greta Thunberg predicted, as she did last year for COP26, that there would just be more blah, blah, blah. Are you more or less an alarmist after COP27?
Well, I think the story of this conference has been interesting in two ways. The first is that very little progress was made in terms of reducing carbon emissions or promises to reduce carbon emissions, which are obviously the things that drive future warming. In that sense, it's a disappointment, although I should note, as a conference, it was not designed to produce much more ambitious pledges. Some of these conferences do that. Some of them are focused on other things. And so it wasn't like this conference failed, but it did not deliver meaningful progress in terms of promises of future emissions reductions. But what it did deliver was the establishment of a new financing facility to support what are called loss and damage payments to climate vulnerable countries. So climate change is a global problem, but it's distributed unequally. Countries in the world that are around the equator primarily, and in general, the poorer countries of the world who've done least to produce the problem are facing the harshest consequences. And as a result, for a couple of decades, they've advocated in forums like these for the principle that the rich countries of the world who benefited from industrialization and produced an enormous amount of carbon along the way should be paying them to help them manage, navigate, and survive the climate impacts that were made inevitable by the development and prosperity of the global north. For the first time in this climate conference, the rich nations of the world have agreed to that. And I do think that that is a quite significant step forward because given the changing shape of expectations for warming this century, as you mentioned in your intro, it now seems likely that some of the worst case scenarios are much less likely, and we're heading for some still scary but not apocalyptic futures. What that means is that the question of distribution, who will be impacted most and how will they manage, sort of becomes more paramount. And I think that this resolution at this COP, COP27 in Egypt, represents the first real global step forward on that front. It's not quite a turning of the page away from decarbonization towards climate justice, but for the first time, you're seeing issues of climate justice addressed directly and prominently by the world's most powerful and richest countries. And I think that that sort of initiates a new chapter of climate geopolitics.
And it was a difficult thing to achieve, required overtime at the conference in order to do it. Critics are still saying that, wait a minute, we haven't decided who's going to pay or how much they're going to pay or who they're going to pay it to. All that needs to be developed. And the U.S. is very concerned about whether China will agree to, in fact, be a donor under these circumstances.
Yeah, I think there are enormous number of open questions here. We're at just the very, very beginning of this negotiation and project. It's like we are on loss and damage where we were in 1992 on climate. So we have a long way to go. And all of the questions that you raised are the open and important ones. But I do still think it's significant, as it was significant in 1992 when the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change was ratified, that we have at least the in-principle commitment of countries like the U.S. who in the past have been quite resistant to this project. We have at least their commitment to try. It's not sufficient, as nothing on climate is, but it represents a step forward that I think is worth pointing out and to some degree celebrating.
You said this particular Congress of the Parties, which is what COP stands for, wasn't designed necessarily to reduce emissions. And yet there are those who are saying that it's backed away in some respects from agreements that were made last year in Glasgow at COP26. How concerned are you about that?
I think it represents a step backward. It's not exactly clear to what extent you can count this as a true step back from those promises so much as a failure to push them forward. We're seeing probably fewer mentions in the final text of the 1.5 degree goal that was sort of introduced in the Paris Agreement and has become a rallying cry for the world's climate activists and the world's climate vulnerable countries since. And we saw a fight that, you know, was lost by more aggressive climate advocates to emphasize the need to not just phase down but phase out fossil fuels. Both of those are rhetorical fights which, you know, little to no progress was made in this agreement compared to last year and in years past. And in climate generally, when we're talking about, you know, a stalemate in which we haven't made progress over previous years, that represents a real lost opportunity given how little time we have to avoid climate catastrophe. On the other hand, you know, given where we were last fall in Glasgow, you know, we're still there. I think we're not in a worse position. We just failed to take the opportunity to make progress. But as I mentioned a few minutes ago, this conference was not designed to elevate those ambitions. It was called the Implementation COP. It was meant to enable not new promises of higher decarbonization ambition, but new agreements and negotiations and frameworks that would allow us to fulfill the promises, us being all the countries of the world, not just the U.S., allow us to fulfill the promises that have been made in the past. And there, I think we haven't made sufficient progress, again, as is always the case with climate. But there's more progress than initially meets the eye.
Well, what about the 1.5 goal? That's something that you've referred to in your more recent writing, as opposed to 2 degrees, which would be catastrophic and apocalyptic. How important is 1.5? What does that mean? Would you explain that to our listeners who've been focused on the politics in the last couple of weeks?
To begin with, the planet is now about 1.2 or 1.3 degrees warmer than the pre-industrial average. So we've raised the planet's temperature by what sounds like not very much, 1.2, 1.3 degrees, but it actually already puts us entirely outside the window of climate temperatures that includes all of human history. So we are already today warmer than we have ever been in the history of human civilization. And as a result, many of the things that were built in that climate and on it, an assumption of its continuity, are coming into question. We're seeing increased risks of agricultural failures. We're seeing infrastructure suffering under new climate conditions. We're seeing more intense droughts and heat waves and wildfires, all the things that your listeners are familiar with. That's just at 1.2 or 1.3 degrees. In Paris in 2015, in response to advocacy from, you know, climate protesters and the most vulnerable countries in the world, who believed that the standard that had been set in previous conferences of limiting warming to 2 degrees was insufficient, the world's governments agreed to try to limit warming at a lower level, 1.5 degrees. The official text of the Paris Agreement says that we're committed to limiting warming to, quote, well below 2 degrees, and we're going to do everything we can to keep it as close to 1.5 as possible. Now, those two benchmarks have formed some of the standards by which we've judged climate action in the intervening 7-8 years. When we learned about the need to cut emissions in half by 2030 to hit our emissions goals, that was what we needed to do to give ourselves a decent chance of limiting warming to 1.5 degrees. When we talk about getting to net zero in 2050, it's the same. Those are the benchmarks that are established by a goal of 1.5 degrees of warming. We also, in the interim, had a report, the 1.5 degree report of 2018 from the UN IPCC, that laid out the difference between what a world warmed by 1.5 degrees would look like compared to a world at 2 degrees. And it was quite stark, which gave further momentum and urgency to this project of limiting warming close to 1.5 degrees. Some of the impacts, you know, we'd expect 150 million additional people dying of air pollution just between those two thresholds, 1.5 degrees and 2 degrees, from the burning of fossil fuels. We'd expect floods that used to hit once a century in many parts of the world would now be hitting every single year. We'd expect that in large parts of South Asia and the Middle East and really all across the equatorial band of the planet during summer, it would be so hot that you couldn't really work outside. And in some cases, you couldn't really safely go outside for long stretches without risking heat stroke and maybe even heat death. This is the difference between 1.5 and 2 degrees. And as a result, the world was quite focused at a rhetorical level of trying to achieve 1.5. But we are really off track to get to that point. You know, we're going to reach a new emissions peak this year. We're probably going to reach a new emissions peak next year, which means all of our dreams of cutting our emissions in half by the end of this decade seem, let's say, quite ambitious. Personally, I think that they're totally out of reach. That doesn't mean that 1.6 or 1.7 or 1.8 degrees is out of the realm of possibility, but 2 degrees is looking more plausible than 1.5 degrees as a sort of best estimate for where we're heading this century. And while that sounds awful given all the scientific impacts that I've just described, and it is, it will be disruptive, it will produce an enormous amount of human suffering, and will raise many questions about the capacity of the world's geopolitics to accommodate that suffering and the migration that it'll likely inspire. 2 degrees of warming is also a lot better than where we thought we were headed just 5 years ago, when the same UN bodies projected what was called a business as usual scenario of 4 or 5 degrees. So, you know, we've missed out on our opportunity to limit warming to 1.5 degrees. I think, practically speaking, we can say that that goal is sort of over with, unfortunately. But we've moved significantly faster than was anticipated just 5 years ago, such that those really, really scary outcomes of 4 and 5 degrees of warming, and potentially even north of there, look much, much, much less likely than they did just a few years ago. And we can probably somewhat safely count on warming between 2 and 3 degrees, even if we do very little more than we're doing right now. We can still do more. We can limit warming. Say, you know, the UN says we're on track for 2.6 or 2.7 now. We can get it to 2. We can even get it below 2. So there's a lot of human agency as well. But I also think, despite all of the bad news we see every day about all of the unprecedented climate impacts all around the world, it's also worth remembering that, you know, given where all the action that's been inspired over the last 5 years and the movement we've undertaken with decarbonization in the interim, we're now expecting, you know, a less apocalyptic future than we were expecting a few years ago. And that represents progress, even if it doesn't allow us to avoid climate disruption, disarray, and suffering.
Just should mention that the degrees we're talking about are degrees centigrade, not Fahrenheit, which would be higher. You mentioned that we're hitting a new emissions peak this year, and we'll probably hit another one next year. So even as we begin to talk about this, even as we have COPs annually, we are still emitting more now than ever before.
Which means that we're doing more damage this year at sort of peak climate consciousness than we've ever done in all of, at any point previous in human history. And that's remarkable on many different levels, including, you know, a fact that I often mention that, you know, we've done half of all the damage that we've ever managed in all of human history just in the last 25 years. So while we think of this as a centuries-long problem that began in the Industrial Revolution in England in the 19th century or maybe 18th century, the truth is the vast bulk of the damage that's been done has been done in recent decades with the full knowledge of the scientific and political community, which is one reason to be somewhat skeptical, as I've been in the past, about how much knowledge and public awareness really can change our climate policy. But we have seen, in ways that I didn't anticipate just a few years ago, that some thresholds have been reached of awareness. Some tipping points have been initiated, and we're not moving nearly fast enough to avoid dangerous climate change. As I said earlier, that's sort of out of reach now. We are still moving fast enough, nevertheless, that some of the things that we were really scared of a few years ago now seem much less likely. And, you know, it's not a neat story. It's not climate victory. It's not climate triumph. But thankfully, it's also doesn't seem likely to be a story of true climate apocalypse either, of the sort that, you know, would bring about the, you know, possible civilizational collapse or the extinction of the human species, which is not something I thought was possible at 4 or 5 degrees, but others, you know, others often talked about it as though it was. Those futures are looking, you know, much less likely. And the future that we're kind of staring at seems to be defined by climate change, transformed by climate change, full of obstacles imposed on us by this warming, but not that are so large that we can't engineer some human future upon that landscape, which is, I hope, what we managed to do.
Doing that engineering, though, turns out to be political as much as it is scientific. I read somewhere that at COP27, there were so many people there from the fossil fuel industry lobbying the heads of state and the delegations. They would amount to the biggest delegation of all. What about that? And what about the iron hand of capitalism, as it always referred to, that grasps for more regardless of what the cost is to the planet?
Well, I think there's actually good news here, which is to say that from a true free market perspective, renewables are already the winner. In 90% of the world's population now lives in places where new renewable capacity is cheaper than dirty energy. The IEA, the International Energy Agency, has called solar power the cheapest electricity in history. And the price declines not just of solar power, but of offshore wind and onshore wind and of the battery technology that's necessary to make that power reliable at large scale. All of those prices have fallen dramatically over the last decade between, depending on which technology you're talking about, between by 60% and 90%. And those cost collapses are expected to continue, if not necessarily as dramatically in the next decade or two, then certainly they're going to keep falling, whereas the price of fossil fuels has stayed at least stable and has had, as we've seen with the Russia invasion of Ukraine, an enormous amount of additional volatility built in, which is all to say that anyone making any medium-term plans now is not thinking about a green transition as a burdensome transition that would be more expensive. And the iron hand of capitalism, as you called it, does not dictate that we stick closer to fossil fuels despite the impacts on the planet. That those laws of capitalism, if they were actually enacted honestly, would mean a much faster renewable transition than the one that we're progressing through right now. It would mean that anyone making any investments would be all in on renewables and nobody would be building out any additional fossil fuel capacity whatsoever. Now, that's not where we are, but that's not because fossil fuels are the choice of capitalism and renewables the choice of the Greens. It is because the fossil fuel business has captured much of the political economy of the world and slowed climate action now for decades. They're slowing it still today. And that means that we are still paying globally hundreds of billions of dollars every year in fossil fuel subsidies. Depending on if you want to count the environmental externalities you mentioned, you can tabulate those subsidies in the trillions annually. And that means that this is not actually a fair fight yet, which is all to say that actually the lowest hanging fruit for climate advocates, is that we remove those fossil fuel subsidies and actually let renewables compete in the open market, because if they did, they would be winning running away. There are huge amounts of public policy questions about exactly how to build out those grids, how to design, an ideal energy mix. I don't mean to say that all we need to do is, let the free market work and the problem will be solved. But on the narrow question of whether our future should be based on dirty energy, which is also, by the way, killing 10 million people a year through air pollution, or clean energy, which is not just cheaper, but also safer and healthier for everyone, particularly those living around the source of that energy. On that narrow question, we don't need to appeal to environmental considerations or even public health considerations. We can just look at the economic calculus and say we would be better off growing cleaner rather than growing in a dirty direction. And I think that represents a real generational shift in how the future looks. And there's one reason why, as I wrote in that recent Times Magazine piece, while we're not at all out of the woods and climate change will be, in many ways disastrous, it's also the case that we're moving much faster than most analysts projected a few years ago, which means that, we're no longer heading for what used to look like an apocalyptic future, only one in which climate has disrupted but not brought to an end all of the promises that we used to take for granted.
When you talk about the economics of nations around the world, of course, that's a multitude of challenges. Let's take a quick look at what's happening here in the United States. We now have a GOP majority in the Congress, Republican majority in the Congress, where spending bills originate. Even when the Democrats were in control, President Biden wasn't able to get everything he wanted, although he did get one big goal, which is $370 billion to be spent to some extent on climate. What's the likelihood that there'll be anything more in the next couple of years coming out of the United States?
Well, I think that we probably won't have a major new piece of climate legislation in the next few years coming out of the U.S. Congress. But a few things about what's happened over the last year or two that I think is worth keeping in mind. You're absolutely right to say that Joe Biden ended up with a much smaller climate package than he had originally hoped for. It's much smaller than climate advocates had been pushing for and much smaller than comparable investments that are being made in some other parts of the world. But the price tag of that IRA bill, the climate bill that's called the Inflation Reduction Act, you know, it's often quoted as $369 billion, but in fact, the outlay may be much, much larger since many of those, much of that spending comes in the form of tax credits. It really depends on how the market responds. And most analysts suggest that the market's going to respond much more aggressively than the Congressional Budget Office has projected, which means that we may actually end up spending much more than $369 billion just on those tax credits. It also helps establish some loan programs coming out of the DOE, which have essentially no limit, which is to say that there could be much, much more aggressive startup lending towards renewable energy than we've ever seen in the U.S. before, and that could really transform the energy landscape going forward. Beyond that, you know, while the IRA got no Republican votes and had to pass by the skin of its teeth, you know, on the whims of Joe Manchin's support, the truth is that two significant previous bills passed the previous year, the Infrastructure Bill and the CHIPS Act, both contained significant climate provisions in terms of, you know, both the need to compete with China for the, you know, in a sort of green energy marketplace, the green energy industrial marketplace, and in the kinds of spending that we're doing on things like school buses and train systems. And those, while the total dollar figures were a little bit smaller than the IRA, they were not at all insignificant. And they got quite a number of Republican votes because they were not understood to be narrow climate bills, but economic competitive bills that had some climate payoffs. I suspect that over the next few years, even if Republicans are still unwilling to vote for things that are headlined on, you know, with climate goals in mind, like the IRA was, that they will be willing to vote for other bills that make investments in clean sectors. And when I look at the U.S., you know, I'm still dispirited by how much climate skepticism there is on the right. On the other hand, I would point out two things. One is that there's much, much less true climate denial than there was just a few years ago. Basically, no elected official or very, very few elected officials are actually in denial of climate change. They just don't want to do anything about it. And while that doesn't sound like meaningful progress, it does represent some amount of progress. And secondly, when you look at the economic benefits of green energy and clean energy across the U.S., they're actually located disproportionately in red states. You know, Texas is the country's biggest provider of clean energy. And if you really roll that forward 5 or 10 years, I just have a hard time imagining the same kind of culture war resistance to climate initiatives, even in red states that we're seeing today, because the economic benefits of continued public support for those projects in those places will be so large. Now, that's not to say, you know, right-wing resistance to climate policy will totally disappear. I suspect there will be some residual resistance, but I think that the sort of pure red-blue stalemate that we've become accustomed to thinking about when we think about climate policy is going to get a bit messier, which is to say there'll be more opportunities for smaller scale initiatives, even in the medium term.
What about the potential for loss and damage, as we talked about earlier in the program, here in the United States? Are we going to see more and more of that? Will that make people more aware of exactly what's going on?
Well, I think we already are. I mean, if we look at the way that hurricanes have affected the insurance market in Florida, for instance, or along the Gulf Coast of Texas, or the way that wildfire seasons have changed the way that fire insurance is structured in California, there are now many places where it's not clear that a private insurance market will endure, which means that more and more of that responsibility will be shouldered by the federal government and state governments, and many homeowners are going to be asked to pay significantly more of their own of their own premium there, which is going to change housing markets. It's going to change local politics, and I think it may change federal climate politics as well. I don't think that we're going to see a mass exodus out of, you know, the coastal areas of Florida. I think that people like that life just too much. But exactly what goes into making those homes relatively safe and insuring them after storms and making sure that the people whose homes and lives were damaged and destroyed by those storms are compensated in some way, I think is going to become a bigger part of our national politics as climate change becomes a bigger part of our national politics. And it is a reminder that however we think about the hierarchies of climate justice and injustice around the world, and it's important to keep in mind things like you know, Pakistan had these incredible monsoon floods this year, which displaced 30 million people, despite the fact that Pakistan produces in its entire historical, you know, industrialization, the entire history of the country has produced only as much carbon as the U.S. produces every single year. Nevertheless, we're seeing many of those same patterns of, you know, both inequality and increasing risk in the rich countries of the world. You know, it's not like Fort Myers, Florida was a place that was totally ignorant to climate risk a year ago or 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And nevertheless, we are sort of building into that vulnerability, expanding our, you know, expanding our development in places that are really quite dangerous in terms of climate change. And as a result, we're going to be reckoning with the impacts of warming much more than if we had taken a more climate responsible path of development a few decades ago. Exactly how that shakes out, I don't know, but it doesn't seem all that likely that we make a U-turn and start retreating from these climate vulnerabilities. It seems much more likely to me that we find creative ways of protecting those people who choose to live in the eye of the storm, so to speak.
In the meantime, of course, as you said, we're not doing enough and things are getting worse. How optimistic is it possible to be?
Well, you know, we talked about those different degree levels earlier, and they sound a little abstract, and probably to your listeners, they, you know, hard to sort of keep them straight. But the truth is, we are already outside the range of temperatures that enclose all of human history, which another way of saying that is we have already entered into a phase of dangerous climate change. Scientists have long called 2 degrees of warming the threshold of catastrophe, and I think it's unlikely, if not impossible, that we stay below that level. But we are not going to be dealing with climate change this century, I don't think, of 4 or 5 or even 6 degrees of warming, which a few years ago seemed the path that we were on. So we have about cut in half our expectations of warming this century in just 5 years, and that's really remarkable. But we've also lost the opportunity to secure sub-dangerous, normal-seeming climate. And as a result, we're going to be living, all of us and all of our children and all of our grandchildren, in a climate muddle between those two poles, well past normal and yet mercifully short of apocalypse. Now, how you think about that future, whether you think of it in optimistic terms or pessimistic terms, probably says more about the sort of political preconceptions that you bring to that question than it does the science itself. The science says the changes will be dramatic. The obstacles to human flourishing will be enormous, but they are not so large that we need to stop imagining a human response and a human future. They are merely large enough that we need to reorient our political project, both at the local and national level and at the international level, towards the job of securing the promise of human flourishing and human justice on the other side of that warming, as opposed to living in fear that warming will be so significant that no hope of human flourishing can survive.
David Wallace Wells, a science journalist at the New York Times, thank you so much for the writing and thinking that you have done about this and your ability to, as you have just done, put together a long-range formulation of what we have to expect and how we might deal with it, depending on where we're coming from. Thanks so much for being on our program.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
The producer of To the Point is Andrea Brody, and our engineer is John Meek. I'm Warren Alney. Thanks so much for joining us. Tune in next time to The Point.